Dr. Robert Rosine is Professor of Historical Theology and Executive Director of the Institute for Reformation Research here at Concordia Seminary, and he will talk about a wonderful Luther's apocryphal apple tree. Robert Rosine.
Thanks very much. As I looked at the program, I wondered if this is really supposed to be the way it is. I'm doing the talk, and the editor of Christianity Today is nice enough to come all this way to do the comment. But Dr. Simonetto said, no, we have to have somebody from the faculty do a main paper. And so he said, you can do something on Lutheran vocation, can't you? Just sort of, you know, basic stuff. I do basic, so I can do this. And I said, yeah, that would be fine. I would do it. I first thought maybe out of a sense of moral obligation and imperative, but that would make me a Kantian, and then I thought I would do it out of guilt. That might make me a Lutheran of sorts, I guess, not a very good one. And I finally decided that I would do it out of a sense of vocation. And because Dr. Simonetto is such a nice guy, you just can't say no. So we will talk a little bit here on Luther and vocation a little bit, some of which you heard in already in the talk, in our first talk from Professor Noel, and you'll hear some other things from a slightly different angle. It's always nice to take a couple of passes at things. And I will stick to the text as best I can and not waver too much. I get off text, then we're really in trouble. A student once said to me, when I had three things sort of going up at the same time in class, I said, this will all make sense once. And he said, oh, we're not worried. He said, these are kind of like Lake Wobegon stories. They all come together about the last minute and a half. And they make sense, but then we know we can't possibly go out and do it again ourselves. And he said, you probably couldn't either, so, which is true. If the world were to end tomorrow, I would plant an apple tree today. Many of you have probably heard the line. It's a catchy saying from Martin Luther, who said a lot of catchy things. But in fact, Luther never said this one. You hear it used, and no one ever knows quite or knew quite where it came from. It's often hard to prove the negative. But Martin Schliemann, a historian, seems to have this one nailed down. I was going to say nailed to the church door since we're just past Reformation Day, but that would evoke the debate about whether Luther nailed them actually or mailed them. One hornet's nest at a time, so we'll stick to the apple tree. The roots of the apple tree quotation are laid bare by Martin Schliemann in a book, Luther's Apfelbäumchen, Luther's Little Apple Tree, the book's subtitle, A Chapter in the History of German Mentality, German Outlook, at the end of the Second World War. It does double duty, touches both on the origin, really, and the use of this. The phantom quotation seems to have come from a typewritten round-robin letter circulated by a German Lutheran pastor at war's end. His parishioners, and many were people, among many people, caught in the madness of the war, fearing they would lose hope, not about the war as such, but about life itself. A pastor, Karl Lotz, wrote, "We need to conform to the Luther saying, if the world were to end tomorrow, we would plant our little apple tree today, and sow the seeds of a quote or sown." Do not blame Schliemann. He is simply carrying out his vocation as a historian. Remember, Luther once said also that historians are the most useful people, and we cannot thank and praise them enough for what they tell us. That is a genuine Luther quotation, I know. That's from the 1538 Gaudeamus Capellus history, his preface to it, but it's in German, so you'll have to take my word for it there. All is not lost, though. Luther may not have said this in so many words, but his fingerprints are all over the theology that's there in this non-quotation. The saying actually does a pretty good job of representing what Luther would have us see now in life here, living in hope and confidence. It's no wonder people have been fooled. If Luther didn't say it, he should have. And in a sense, he really did. In Luther's day, everyone expected Christ to come and to judge the living and the dead. And some then tried to go on and do the math. Anticipation intensified in some quarters as certain years rolled around. 1500 is a nice round year. And since the second coming hadn't happened in 1000, assuming anybody could actually calculate then when 1000 was, 1500 is a good shot. Or 1533 might be even be better, since Christ presumably is 33 when he ascends and promises then to come again. and that sparked apocalyptic flare-ups in places like Strasbourg or the famous Kingdom of Münster up in the north. That latter episode was enough of a threat to prompt the Roman Catholic and evangelical princes to do their vocations and cooperate and snuff out the rebellion. But even if people are not inclined to sit on rooftops to await the trumpet's call, they still expected Christ to come. In the meantime, what should these people be doing in God's created order? Were they making any valuable contribution? Depended upon who you were, what you did, and whom you asked. The risk of oversimplifying, the medieval world, one might say, championed a model of the viator. You probably won't like this, but it's okay. This is for rhetorical purposes. The viator, the pilgrim who walked the via, the way, the path, the road. Do not be caught up in the things of this world, but keep your eye on the prize in the kingdom to come. The world is to be outlasted, endured, not embraced. As people pass through, they were either in godly or sacred callings, God-pleasing service of something like, let's say monks, nuns, bishops, and the like, people in ecclesiastical professions, sacred vocations. Or they were in the other camp, weavers, housewife, leather worker, butcher, baker, candlestick maker, not to mention the mine owner father or the son sent to the university for law school. You can catch the allusion there. In those callings, they were just living out their days till Christ comes again. Want to do something really valuable, a really good work, then make a pilgrimage, light a candle, sponsor a mass, or some such thing. Thunderstruck, literally, and figuratively by his sin, Luther tried to walk the straight and narrow, shifting to a sacred vocation as monk. His superiors saw promise, and they saw talent, and they moved him on, priest, then professor. When some later complained that Luther was upsetting the church, he replied, in effect, "Don't blame me, I was made a doctor of theology against my will." Professors were supposed to contribute to the advancement of theological knowledge, and so when Luther found the gospel, personally, he took it back into the classroom and out to, over to the printer's house and off into the larger church. He's only carrying out his vocation. "I cannot thank John Eck enough," Luther said elsewhere, "for he has forced me to rethink theology. If I were Pope, I would give Eck a cardinal's hat, and then I'd promptly burn it." That is probably crossing the vocational line, but the fact is, so much of the Reformation story happens because reformers, Luther and others, carried out their callings that they were given, whether they had time to think about it or not. What should they, or we, think about vocation? One good source is Luther's famous treatise from 1520. There are many good ones, but this is a good place to start, a basic foundation. An appeal to the ruling class of the German nationality as an amelioration of the state of Christendom. To cut it short, an appeal to the Christian nobility. We put it in the modern idiom, a call on the nobles to fix things in the church. Hopes for quick reform, perhaps unrealistic, bogged down as bishops dragged their feet. Rome had thrown up a wall, Luther said, to keep out others who would want to step in, separating sacred and secular vocations. Matters of church, including reform, were the purview of the sacred. "Not so," said Luther. "There is no such divide. The distinction is rather between those who live God-pleasing lives in their vocations and those who do not. The line cuts another way, on different grounds." Luther's rethinking of vocation is really radical, radix, to the root of the thing. And while leading reform was first the work of the bishops, he conceded that. If they failed, then the nobility should step in and provide the evangelical change. Not that they themselves are priests, but like David and Solomon of old, they could see to it that the people have right religion. Nobles are, in effect, father figures for the territory with responsibility to provide. We talked last time about how some of Lutheranism is rooted back in the Middle Ages. You can root this back in the Old Testament, if you want. Or stay in the Middle Ages. You know, we think Luther is radical sometimes. He's really looking back at this, not introducing something new. He's got 500 years of tradition back, at least to the days of Urban II, where emperors were claimed to be the patrons and the protectors of the church to make sure things worked well and that things were right. Well, in Luther's radical rethinking, what mattered was not the vocation itself, but how it was fulfilled. assuming the vocation is not something like bank robber, I would say. Is a particular calling a responsibility done by a Christian, by one acting out of faith, moved by the grace and love of Christ? Is it selfless, giving service because of Christ's Spirit, or is it done from some other motivation, some other reason, with hope for gain or reward that would at bottom promote me? That's the divide, not sacred, secular. In this way, it is not just the priest who truly does a good work, but also the sexton, the custodian who sweeps the floor, stokes the furnace, and opens the church doors on Sunday. Doing it all not to get himself voted sexton of the year, but because it fulfills his vocation. He understands that God puts people in all sorts of positions in life, spots and roles, and people serve God who has redeemed them and then left them there in the world to serve. Goes for the sexton, along with everybody else who shows up for Sunday morning, the farmer, the lawyer, the editor, the husbands, wives, children, nurses, teachers, and more. They please God by coming to worship, of course, and they certainly get something in the word and the sacrament. But I'm referring also to the God-pleasing service they render when they walk out the door and through the week by faithfully doing the tasks God puts before them in daily life. For the Christian, it's very simple. Whatever is not sin is God-pleasing service. What is not done from selfish desire, which would be sin, pleases God, and those redeemed by God are put in the world to be useful. Now, Lutherans say God works through means. We usually think in terms of means of grace and what we call the kingdom or the realm or the reign of the right hand. In the right, God saves people, accomplishing it by means of the gospel that comes in the word, proclaimed, heard, read, and received in the sacraments, baptism, Lord's Supper, something visible linked with promises heard, given and shed for you. That's means. But God also uses means in the realm of the left hand, that is, in God's created order all around. For now, we're especially interested in people in the left hand and what they do, as God's means there. Luther spoke of larvae Dei, masks of God. People in the world are God's hands, doing what he would accomplish. He could reach down and pluck up the thief himself, but he leaves that to law officers to get the job done. He could sow and reap and feed, but he leaves that to farmers. Maybe God would be better off doing the things himself, but he's chosen a different route. True, not all the hands he uses are the most skilled, but as the German proverb goes, you plow with the oxen God gives you. God uses all sorts of means and masks in the left hand, not just Christians. The Turk, thought Luther, served God's purpose. In 1529, the Turks had made it up the Danube as far as Vienna and threatened to get beyond and into the empire. Though Luther would hardly claim to know the mind of God, he suggested that the Turk was perhaps a wake-up call for the Germans. Today, Turks also serve, and they are past Vienna and into German lands. When I was in the Frankfurt train station 2 weeks ago, a Turk served me a bratwurst and a beer at a stand-up lunch counter between trains. But in all seriousness, this is actually an example also of God getting things done in little ways, from big to little, masks of God all around. That goes for the believer and the non-believer alike. And if this fellow at the sausage stand also happened to be a convert to Christianity, and if this convert carried out his lunch counter duties because he wanted to do well for his employer, for his customers, for his family that he supports, then he'd be doing a good work in that vocation. Not spectacular, though the brat was pretty good. I'll chalk that up, however, to the butcher doing his vocation. I simply want to illustrate the fact that through small things as well as large, God moves the world along. Masks all around everywhere. The small things done by believers are God-pleasing works. So do Christians think of this larger, what do we think of this larger theological framework? Or do we simply slog away and never realize that we're God's instruments for getting things done? Puts a new look, a new twist, I think, on daily life. It may save us from another problem. We've learned the lesson of Luther's appeal to the Christian nobles, and so we steer clear of the sacred secular pothole, only sometimes to hit others. There are several we could avoid, but for the sake of time, let's touch just on one. How does one live a life of service to God? Some people head for the how-to books, lay out stages or steps toward truly Christian life. I do not want to tar all with the same brush, It is true there seems to be little redeeming value in something that preaches a gospel of prosperity. Believe this, do this, and God certainly will want to bless you, and... But it would hardly be fair to lump them all together like that. I know better than that. Better to take each on its own. This past summer, I was at the International Conference on Evangelical Theological Education, ISET, with all sorts of evangelicals there, and a Lutheran. Actually, two Lutherans. One from our partner church in Russia. And it was interesting to even hear the discussions there on how some are much more interested in this approach than others are very critical. So people are not all alike. I'd suggest, though, that if, in fact, we really don't need them in the first place. Should I be trying to discover some new higher calling, lest my life be otherwise worthless? Do I need to seek out a sanctified path that's said to get me closer to God? Actually, I believe that I am as close to God as I'm going to get this side of the second coming, because he's with me in Christ Jesus, and heaven is mine now. But I want to be careful not to set up straw men. Simply to say we really don't need the how, I'd simply say we don't need the how-to section, and leave it at that. We might rather return to small catechism, where Luther reminds us that God has made me and all creatures, that he's given me my body and soul, eyes, ears, and all my members, reason, and all my senses, and still preserves them. Why? Simply for life in this world. The redemption in the second article means life created and preserved in the first is for Christians, their service to God. Luther's catechism explanation for the commandments do not prescribe special works for life, but they describe how people are people that God has called to faith, and so we fear and love God, that. And in the second table, we see relationships and interactions that are bound to occur in all sorts of situations and callings in life. We see authority, responsibility for parent, and responsibility exercised by parents, respect toward the same. We see respect for life, husband-wife relationships, property, reputation, and so forth and so on. Nothing spectacular. But apply those to your callings, and there is more than enough to keep you focused and busy. And, dear Christians, you will even be carrying out your vocations in a God-pleasing fashion. There is another Luther saying. At least the admissions office put it at the bottom of an e-memo and said it was Luther. So if this turns out to be another apple tree, blame the admissions office. It's a saying that says, that goes like this. The Christian cobbler is one who first of all makes good shoes, not poor shoes with little crosses on them. Christians sometimes think they have to do more, but this is not so. Just do what God lays on you. So the tricky thing, of course, is to sort this all out. The expectations, the responsibilities, they become sometimes practically impossible. And sometimes responsibilities fall by the wayside, for which there is repentance, forgiveness, and a new day with vocations when the sun comes up tomorrow. Also, despite the fact that within larger Christendom we're not all precisely on the same page theologically, it is certainly possible to work and cooperate in matters of vocation, I think, on particular practical issues as this goes along. It may not lead to anything larger. Some years ago, I was at the International Ecumenical Research Institute in Strasbourg. Their week-long theme was, can ethical cooperative work lead to larger ecumenical doctrinal agreement? And they put us in small groups, and it took us 10 minutes to decide no. But that was no reason why people, to go backwards like that. There was no reason, however, why people sometimes who had very different approaches to things could not see in the end a same goal and work together in a common action there. Christians do it. Different denominations live together in an urban core and work together in neighborhood watch programs. Congregations that are there can cooperate if that makes the organization easier. And whether they do it as individuals or congregations, they do it really as residents there in that neighborhood, in the world there. I don't know if Luther ever planted apple trees to support his family. He did have a small farm, but the management fell to Katie, who had the business sense, and work seems to have been done by others. Luther had his own callings and did some other things rather well. And if he didn't write about the apple trees, at least the ones in the famous quotation, he wrote about a lot of other things that have helped us. The German pastor who used the non-quote, may have stumbled a bit when he put words in Luther's mouth, but he was really just trying to carry out his own vocation at the time, building up Christians whose world was figuratively and literally crashing down all around them at war's end. What should they do? Many had no longer homes, businesses, jobs. Vocation? Where should they look? Well, but if nothing else, do the little things, the fundamental things. Hang on to what little is left with the hope that might later prove to be a starting point for rebuilding. Be neighbor. Share as needed. Gather what is left of the family and remind them of God's love in Christ, even when the love seems nowhere around. And pray for the land that God would preserve and deliver and bring them to a new day if he sees fit. Certainly will bring them to a new day in the life to come. Luther understands service to God as service in this world, in this life. The vocations are the way it gets done. The world may end tomorrow, we can't say, but it does not matter. In the right-hand realm, God gives us what we need, and we lay hold of it, that which he puts in front of us. And in the left, we do our best to meet the expectations of vocation. And along the way, we would do well to learn the lesson of Ecclesiastes, that the race is not to the swift, the battle is not always to the strong. Meaning, you have the task to plan, but no guarantee that you can give the outcome. God takes care of that. I have no grand scheme, no great plans for revitalizing society and the world. I will start with what I'm doing, what's here in myself, and work from there. And meanwhile, until we are notified that we do not need to clock in, we will get on with the tasks at hand wherever we find ourselves. We plow with the oxen God gives us. We may even plant an apple tree, too. Thank you.